Welcome to the Behavioral Health Collective podcast, a community of behavioral health professionals who are passionate about working together across disciplines to improve client outcomes by valuing collaboration, connection, humility, and evidence-based practices in a variety of behavioral health fields. The goal of the Behavioral Health Collective is to highlight stories of collaboration between practitioners, the work they're doing together, and how thoughtful and ethical collaboration between fields can lead to better client outcomes. Thanks for joining me today to dive deeper into stories of professional collaboration.
If you work with school-age learners, chances are you've attended an IEP meeting or definitely will at some point in the future. Some behavior analysts, like one of our guests today, specifically advocate for learners throughout the IEP process as their full-time role. If you've been in more than a couple IEP meetings, chances are you've been in at least one that's had some tension or contentious issues come up. Today, our guests Annie McLaughlin, BCBA, and education lawyer Alexandra Rosenblatt will discuss this tricky area in which they specialize and provide some insight on how professionals can help collaborate with school teams and families throughout the IEP process. They're both parents of neurodiverse learners and share their professional and personal experience of being around the IEP table. This is a powerful conversation as they have a great deal of wisdom and insight for parents, educators, and behavioral health professionals alike.
Good morning, Alexandra and Annie. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm just so excited to hear more about your perspectives and how you've been working together. So thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So just to get things going, could you describe to me as a lawyer and an IEP advocate a little bit about your respective roles right now and maybe just a short summary of your professional journey to date?
Sure. So my role mostly right now is I serve as an educational consultant or IEP advocate. And really what I do is help families navigate the IEP process and provide them my professional opinion on, you know, anything related to the IEP and its implementation. And so I've basically gotten to this route. I was a special educator. I was a behavior analyst working in clinic and then home settings, and then moved to, I got my doctorate along the way, and then came to the Baltimore, Maryland area where I was really trying to find a job that fit with having young kids because I had one young child and didn't want to do nights and weekends. So I was looking for a school kind of time job. And really, I kept going to IEP meetings to help families and then realized, oh, wait, like this really lights me up inside to help families navigate the IEP process, help them understand what schools should be doing, why they might struggle with it, and then come up with a solution really around communication and implementation. So then I started to get to know the special ed attorneys in the area specifically because as an advocate, you can only go so far. You can give your opinion, right? And then if sometimes schools might disagree or have trouble implementing, then, you know, it is helpful to have an attorney who also knows the law and kind of next steps for that as well.
And I think for me, I think sort of the way that I concisely distinguish the difference between what someone like Annie does and what someone like I do is, you know, typically if a client or a parent is looking to just improve the IEP, not just improve, but improve the IEP to make it better, to work with the team and collaborate, then I would refer them to an educational consultant, right? Because they're obviously, like Annie, their background is in special education, or that's certainly who I recommend because there isn't a certification for being an advocate, but specifically an educational consultant is better equipped than I am to develop goals and objectives and to talk about curriculum and back mapping and all of the in terms of the accommodations. I think generally when we often say that we're sort of the last resort is that like when it's not working or when the team isn't listening or when something drastic needs to change, they bring me in. And then oftentimes the reason why I end up working with Annie is because then I'm needing experts to either go into the school and conduct observations and give me and give the parent feedback, and or I'm looking for her expertise to provide recommendations because that's what I rely upon. So for me, these cases, they're kind of more akin to medical malpractice cases where it's all about relying upon the experts. And so that's what I do is, you know, I can make an argument until the cows come home, but I'm not an expert in it, and Annie is. And so she's the one that provides the recommendations, and I provide the legal arguments as to why they should be listening to her. And sometimes parents hire us to just go with them and sort of be a more heavy hand with the team. And sometimes that's appropriate. But I think it really depends on sort of how acrimonious things have become with the team and whether or not they're just looking for collaboration and input.
Okay, interesting. So I guess just to understand the context of, you know, the American school system and your roles there, how often, I guess, what does that look like when you're coming in? So you're saying sometimes it's acrimonious and other times it's just more like, hey, we need some help. What does that typically look like? I guess if you could say, like, is there a general more than 50% of the time they're hiring one of you first? Are you ever hired kind of together to come in? What does it look like? And is it really common for families to have an IEP advocate and or an education lawyer hired?
Yeah, I would say, curious to hear what Andrew thinks, but I think it actually goes both ways. Sometimes people start with me and we're moving right along and things are very collaborative and teams are doing wonderfully. And then, you know, I'm like, well, we don't need an attorney. We're good. Right. But then sometimes we just get to a point where there's just disagreement for whatever reason. And then the referral would be to an attorney. And there are lots of attorneys in the area. I like working with Alexandra, but there are different people also as well. So it's not that I send every client to her. And then I do think, you know, she also will call me for specific reasons. And given my background in behavior analysis, you know, it tends to be around kids that might be having challenging behaviors interfering with their learning or autism or looking at an FBA, a functional behavior assessment as part of the process as well. I would say most families don't even know that advocates exist until they kind of have a challenge and then connect with other parents. And really the parents are saying, you should bring somebody with you. And my goal really when I go with families is that they feel empowered to show up and have their voice heard in a way that is meaningful for them. And so I really do a lot of background work with the families before we even get to the meetings, just about explaining and identifying their values, what they would like to see either in the IEP or in the relationship with the school. So, you know, it's a little bit, I actually think many families don't have advocates. They don't know that advocacy exists, or they think because things aren't really bad that they don't need somebody. And we're plenty busy. I promise you, we don't need the extra business. But honestly, having somebody, I have taken somebody with me to my child's 504 meeting. So I think having somebody else, like I show up as the mom when I'm at my child's 504, where you just show up with so much emotion, right? And so things feel so personal. So I do think having somebody with you, whether it's an advocate, an attorney, or a friend, particularly looking at where you are on needing support, is really important.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I am also a parent. In addition to being an attorney, I have a fourth grader with Down syndrome. And even just opening up emails from her team gives me stress in a way that I don't experience at all with very real, very intense issues with my clients. So when you're the parent, it feels very different. There feels like the stakes are so incredibly high, and your ability to problem solve, and because it's all about paying attention to the detail. And so if you're stressed, your brain sort of shuts down and it's hard to focus on the details, or it's hard to tell the team, these people who are caring for your children every day, that they're not doing what your child needs. There's so much emotion that goes into that. And so just having another person there, regardless of who they are, is helpful. Someone to take notes, someone to advocate on your behalf so that you can be the parent and not play all the roles, not put all the hats on. And so I think definitely, like, I would always recommend that someone go in with someone, that a parent go in with an advocate or someone there, just because it helps emotionally. It helps to keep track of what's been decided, what's been discussed. And I think part of what happens is, you know, in our society, we sort of defer to the schools as the experts. And so that power dynamic it starts off being unequal. And it's really, really intimidating to walk into a room of 14 people all talking about what your kid can't do. I mean, that's just so emotional. So I think in that respect, it's always good to have someone with you. And then I think in terms of my role, it ends up being, I mean, I thought when I went to this field that I would do more of what Annie does. But I think because, frankly, my rates are higher and people are doing a cost-benefit analysis, that it really only, for a lot of families, not all families, but for probably the average family, it really only makes sense to bring me in when it's just not going well, or they're looking for a change of placement, and it, you know, that cost-benefit analysis is, makes sense for them.
Okay. Interesting. That's a really valid point that you both bring up as parents, that your services that you provide are both hard skills, but also soft skills too. And just being that person beside the parent to support. And I can see how that would be so valuable. And as someone who has come from the education system, that's something that, that's a good reminder for me actually, and maybe for any teachers listening, that it can be really intimidating going into a school. And like, we might not see that way, see it that way as a teacher and educator, you know, and just thinking, oh, it's a school meeting, no problem. But for a parent coming in, that's so true, especially if it's your first child or first one with significant needs, and just hearing the negative, that's hard.
Yeah, I think oftentimes, I mean, I would say 98% of the time that a parent comes to me, they're absolutely right that there's been FAPE violations, but they're arguing the wrong things. They don't quite understand what to be looking at. And I think that's partly what Annie and I can do, is we speak the language, we know what data to rely upon. So the parent is right, but we like translate it.
Yeah, I can see how that's such a valuable service, you know, to be able to speak to both sides.
Yeah. And if you think about the parent's learning history, right? So you might be a teacher with all good intentions, calling the parent, texting them, being super transparent, but they've had six teachers before you, right? Who maybe one wasn't, or one, you know, so the learning history of the family for their interaction with the school, even if everybody at that table at that particular time is really showing up around collaboration and communication, is, I do think there are a lot of players almost always at the table, right? And sometimes there has been issues along the way that the current team almost always is not aware of. And so I think that I also try with that communication to kind of say, listen, we're bringing this up because last year there were X, Y, and Z happened. So we're just making sure. I know you think it won't happen, but we need to make sure everybody's on the same page. So I think a lot of what I do is just also to make sure that everybody kind of knows the history, so that we're not dwelling in the past, but there are reasons that there might be some mistrust or emphasis on communication or emphasis on safety, the discussions at the table.
Now, I'm curious, this answer might be different for both of you, but what are some of the most common scenarios you find yourself going into?
I mean, again, I think a lot of cases I am, since we are sort of the last stop for parents, I think that, again, as even though I really wanted to be focusing on being committed to improving the public school system and making it work for parents, for me, and so this is different for Annie, for me, it's often, this isn't working, we need to change. How do we get out of here? And so oftentimes what I'm doing, not always, but oftentimes I would say the majority of the work that I do is getting students into what's called the non-public special education school. It's one of the more restrictive settings on the least restrictive environment on the LRE page of the IEP that's saying this child can't be educated in public schools, either as a result of the failure of the district to provide a free and appropriate public education, which is the legal standard, and or because that's simply what they need going forward. The public school system doesn't have what this child needs. And so it's, you know, that's oftentimes what I'm doing. So I think that's probably very different than the majority of what Annie is doing.
Yeah, so I get a lot of calls from pre-K and kindergarten parents, and then middle school, whenever that starts. And a lot of parents wanting to know just what should be in this document. Like, I don't even know, help me understand. So I get a lot of, we're getting ready to go into kindergarten, we're getting ready to go into middle school, and I'm afraid that, right? So they're really worried about safety. I get lots of safety concerns, particularly around bullying or navigating the building, you know, staying in the building and not leaving. So oftentimes parents are calling that with just some help me understand, or I want to make sure we're situated to ask for what the child needs. And it's kind of, I've had a couple parents say, I didn't know I was not saying the right thing, right? Like, I didn't know if I said, can the child have a one-to-one? And the answer is, we don't do that. and we do it this way, right? Like they're actually getting some of the same pieces or services. It's just called something different, right? So we get a lot of parents who are just wanting to make sure they're saying the right thing or asking the right questions. But then I also do get a lot of calls, unfortunately, of families in crisis, particularly around behavior or mental health. So kids that won't leave their house to go to school, kids who have significant challenging behaviors, including, you know, self or others, around not being able to access instruction. So usually I go in and do an observation to multiple reasons, but to look and help the team, are they able to implement? Then they always ask me questions and things like that, as well as do we need to kind of start a process for assessments, changes to the IEP and things like that. So usually it's a curiosity of support, or unfortunately parents are in crisis related to behavior.
And ours is, we sort of joke, is like fourth grade. Whereas it's like, they've tried to make the school work for kindergarten, for first, and they start really noticing things at second grade, and that's worse in third grade, and then they hit a wall at fourth grade. That's a really common age that they end up coming to us.
Okay. Interesting. Now, I'm curious about how you first, I can really see now how your work complements each other. How did you first meet? And were you both on the same case? Like a family hired both of you? And how did that first happen?
So I think we were introduced by a friend who, like somebody who knew us both and said, you two should actually talk to each other.
Now the comptroller of Maryland.
Yeah, she's now the comptroller of Maryland. So she...
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. And do you ever, so it sounds like you've referred each other, you know, other families to each other. Do you ever just consult with each other? Like, hey, I've got a question on this, back and forth. I can see how that would be so powerful to just know someone in a complimentary role.
Yeah, we often text each other hardly during IEP meetings. What about this? What should we have for this? Yeah, I mean, I think in part being a similar age, both being women, both being parents of children with needs, I think we both kind of look to each other for our expert opinion on, like, she knows more about the ins and outs of assessments or things about the curriculum that I don't know. And so, yeah, she's probably, you know, definitely... I look to the consultants that we regularly use to just ask questions about things, because in the end, I end up having to sort of become an expert in special education, which of course it's not my background. I'm a lawyer, but I've sort of had to learn along the way. And similarly, I think with someone like Annie, obviously she's not a lawyer, but she has to learn along the way about what goes into making a legal case if ultimately her client needs to go that route.
And we do try to keep it, right, like kind of really zoomed out, or can you, they said this, does that sound right? No. Okay. So then, you know, then we just move on rather than, because we do have to keep some confidentiality and district stuff pretty separate. So we just try to, I would say, keep it surface level, and we're both pretty good at that.
Yeah, certainly we both have confidentiality obligations.
And this makes me think about additional resources, like if there's an IEP advocate out there or an education lawyer, what are the best ways to learn? Is it to reach out to someone in a complimentary role? And has that been the best way to just learn what you need to learn, Annie, for education law, and for Alexandra about special ed? Or are there better, like, are there other resources out there that people can go to?
Yeah, I mean, we spend a lot of time learning from each other, right? Or even asking questions around cases, you know, and I will say there are times that we also look at a case differently, right? And we kind of have to go back and forth about what we think should happen or what the next steps should be. So having those conversations and reaching out, because every attorney that I worked with has a slightly different style and a slightly different approach, different background, different expertise that they bring to the table. So I love to talk to the attorneys about different cases and get their input to hear how things might be different. So I do think that general connection, particularly for advocates that are just starting out, I think connecting with special ed attorneys and kind of letting them know what you bring to the table, maybe, and like why that's different or similar to other advocates, particularly if you are a related service or behavior analyst, like what expertise are you showing up with so that they know when to call you? Because I think, as Alexandra said, I'm not her only educational consultant that she works with, right? Like, why would she call me over, you know, some of the other ones? I think you just want to make sure you know your area that you can contribute the most to.
Yeah, that makes sense. Anything on your end, Alexandra, that you'd recommend for special ed? I'm sorry, for someone in your role to be learning more about special ed.
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely specialized. And so I think for me, it was really learning as you go. And I think what I've experienced, especially dealing with opposing counsel on cases, so cases of where there's an attorney that's representing the districts, like the more they know about special education, the better they are at their job, because they understand what makes a case and what the violations are. And without that, you cannot argue the FAPE violations, because you've got to understand the education. And so I think it definitely has been a learn as I go approach going to IEP meetings. I think generally, like, and I've had providers thank me for being at their meeting, or saying, I've learned a lot by having you at our meetings. Because I think one thing that happens is that, like, I've done trainings for special educators, and what's super, super common is, like, someone at some point, however many years ago, said some rule that may or may not have any basis in the law. Like, we can't do an IEP unless the child is 2 years behind. No. But that became truth to them. Or there's so many of those. I mean, I feel like I spent the whole training of special educators being like, no, that's not true. No, that's not true. Like, no, that's not based in, but some principal or some policy person said that to them at some point, or they heard something in a professional development and they think that's the way it's done. And I think that's oftentimes where the violations come in, where the team says, we don't do it this way. And that is often when I train parents, like, as soon as you have a team that says, we don't do that here, or we don't do it this way, then you say, you know, please provide me the law that says that. And so when I'm at IEP meetings and I'm saying, well, actually the law says this, or like, that's not correct, there's nothing in the law that says that, educators are learning from that. And so I think it's just kind of like a learn as you go. And the more you're involved in IEP meetings with people that really understand what they're doing, including, you know, central office people. I think a lot of the times the school-based people haven't been provided sufficient training for developing an IEP or knowing what to do when they need to discuss the least restrictive environment or whether or not they can meet that child's needs. Oftentimes that central office people really know more than they do. And so having those people at your meetings, I think you can learn a lot from in terms of what is the procedure that you have to follow.
I feel like education law is, you know, if you're going to just look, a parent is going to look up on Google education law for the states or your specific state, that's probably not easily digestible. Like, are there any resources out there for either providers or parents that make it break it down a little bit, like a step before actually hiring a lawyer, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I do try to encourage parents, if you can find it in your state statutes, that it is meant to be written in a way that you can understand it. It's not always that way, but there should be some guidance. Each state also has certain requirements that they have to meet. So they have to have procedural safeguards. So you should definitely go on your state department's education website. They should be freely accessible there. But there are also, you know, some good resources, particularly in rights law, that rights law is a good resource as well.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, I was a lawyer before my 10-year-old daughter was born. And I can tell you that it wasn't even easy for me to understand or read. I think there's a lot to navigate. I mean, even reading an IEP, I was an attorney, and like reading my own kid's IEP is confusing. And I do think that there is this element of educators being the experts and not really empowering parents. And I do think that they're often, these laws are not written in a way that is digestible. And so, yeah, I would agree. I was going to say rights law as well. And then, you know, for example, in Maryland, we have what's called the Parents' Place of Maryland. Our own particular Down syndrome group has mentors. I think Facebook has been a real godsend to a lot of parents. It connects parents in a way that we weren't before and can share resources. But I would probably start with the rights law books. Because the reality, even when I've like done presentations and I've Googled things, like I found wrong information. Or it'll be state by state, and so you're not looking at your own state. So it can be a little bit tricky to know what the law is or understand what the law is.
And I also think whatever kind of parent group, whether it's by disability or age or county or state or something like that, the connection with other parents is really amazing and is super supportive. Definitely go there. I think there's also just a little bit of caution, right, that each person brings their own history to that as well. And in a good way, schools have evolved over time, and hopefully, you know, if a parent had a negative experience 5 years ago, that may not be something that would impact your child as well then. So I do have some parents call me and say, my kid can't go to the school because 10 years ago this happened, right? And so I think it's important to, I love that connection, but just to make sure that as people are kind of connecting to other people for stories, that you do get some context around that.
And just as educators get the law wrong, parents can also get the law wrong. And so sometimes I'll, because I'm on lots of Down syndrome groups and like other special education groups on Facebook. So I'll see a parent say something and I want to be like, no, that's not quite right. But, you know, so it's just with a word of caution.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, in terms of working with parents, I'm curious, you did say earlier, Annie, that most of the time when you come in, often the parent is right about what they are requesting from the school. I'm curious for both of you though, have you been in and how do you navigate situations where, yeah, potentially they are off base or they're requesting something that is not actually legally required or unreasonable for the circumstances or the school resources, things of that nature?
Yeah. So that's a great question. I will say I really start with a strong values discussion with parents. And it's not usually, I don't say, hey, we're going to start talking about values, right? But if they come to me and say, I want X or this is happening, right? Their experience is almost never validated by the school because they're worried about repercussions. So like, I really do spend a decent amount of time hearing them, giving them space to tell me the full story. And during that discussion, I really am looking for their values as they have identified them, right? And so whether it's high academic achievement, inclusion socially, decreased challenging behaviors, fear for the future, right? There's a lot of common themes that can come up. And I am usually pretty transparent once we kind of get past that, I say like intake or initial discussion around, they don't have to do that, right? If they ask for something and it's like, you know, they don't have to do X, right? Or they don't have to do Y. But what I hear you saying is that you're worried about progress, right? And so let's figure out how we can get more information around progress, or let's figure out how we can make sure the supervision on the playground is safer, right? You can't have 10 people on the playground just for your particular child. I mean, maybe somebody could, but in general, that was the request that was somewhat off base. I would say something along the lines of, but what I hear is that safety. And so let's make sure we go into a meeting with the requests that are, I would say, usually reasonable, right? I want to show up with something that has taken a concern, digest it, and put it in some ways that can actually be implemented. And if it can't, then we need to be talking about why it can't be and where it can be. But in general, starting with, let's make sure we're showing up with a request that addresses the parent's concern and is reasonable. And truly, I have many text messages and can I talk to you outside around the corner thanking me for coming, right, from the school side, because I'm able to take out some of that emotion and translate from both sides to be able to really come up with something that everybody is agreeable to. And my job is to make sure that the outcome is what the child needs, right? So I kind of feel like I'm kind of sometimes a mediator, but knowing that, you know, the client is usually the child, right? And keeping and making sure that the parents are heard and seen in that conversation, because oftentimes they aren't. Or like Alexander said, like they're saying something and the school can't even, well, we can't put 10 people on there, right? And they're not jumping to the need that is really underlying that request.
Hmm. Okay. Has that happened with you, Alexandra, where there's kind of a mismatch in?
Well, I think it's really different with me, because really the leading question that people have for me is, do I have a case? So they're looking for my advice on whether or not something can be done, as opposed to, this is what I want and I want you to do it. And two, because I'm dealing with the law, it's much more black and white. And so it's like either this is a violation or it's not. Either they're legally obligated to do this or they're not. And so I generally find that people are looking to me for those answers, and there's not usually, you know, a concern about whether or not, like, if I say to someone, I really don't think you have a case here for whatever it is, I think they're much more relieved to know that they're going to hear that from me, as opposed to I'm going to have you retain me and not be able to be successful in winning your case for you. And so I think that's sort of like people appreciate my honesty when it comes to me saying, I can't do what you're wanting.
Do you often have, I guess, how common is that for a family to come, and it, are most of the people that come to you like, yes, there is a case there. And so there's like, there are a lot of violations happening in schools, or yeah, that is the case.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the sad reality is the IDEA has never been fully funded, and I could probably walk into any school and find violations for children. I mean, it is an overwhelming problem. But again, I think oftentimes the parent's gut is right. They just don't have the language, or they don't know how to point to the data to support what they're saying. It is remarkable. Like, they really usually are right.
And while those violations are happening, right, I think the hard part for me sometimes, just as a professional, is I really think the vast, vast, vast majority of the people sitting at the table from the school district are doing the absolute best they can. Right. So, but as we know, right, they can't meet the need of the child for whatever reason that is. Right. And I mean, the things we see are, you know, not enough training or supervision. And I say that not as a behavior analyst, but just levels of support. Right. Like, everybody kind of has needs for continued development. And it's not professional development of being pulled out, get 3 hours of a training and go back. Right. But the coaching and the ongoing support, caseload, paperwork. Right, which a lot of that comes down to funding. And so it's really hard to sit at a table of 10 minimum people and say, you're not meeting this kid's needs, because everybody is truly, I mean, I almost always, right, people are like crying, and I'm like, I know you're doing everything you can. I know you're working nights and weekends. I know this kid has been the top of your, like, and you're trying. So I think it can get really emotionally hard for me, because I do think sometimes, right, like, they're trying. They really are doing everything they can. It just still is not quite what that child needs for their particular free and appropriate public education.
That's hard. That's a really hard mismatch. And I mean, we certainly see them in the Canadian system as well, where it's a mismatch of the rights of the child and the actual resources available. And that's tricky. I don't know. Do you have any, either of you have kind of wisdom in those situations where, like, the resources available at the school level, whether that's, like you said, like, supervision wise or assistive tech and stuff, are you going more to bat with the board sometimes? Cause like the school does appear to be doing whatever they can and they need more resource from the board.
Well, I think the most fruitful meetings that we tend to have, and I think Annie would agree with me, are when you've got people outside of the school coming to your meetings. Because I think schools, teachers and educators also feel like their own island. And they're limited in what they can provide. And so it really is helpful to have someone from central office who can say, like, we can provide someone from central office, or we can give funding for this to happen, or we can authorize a one-to-one adult support, or we have a BCBA at the central level. Or so I think they're just more aware of resources, and that can be helpful.
Yeah. And I really try from a consulting perspective to suggest efficient, right? Like, not only effective, but super efficient systems changes or requests that I know are going to be easier, right? So I use all of that behavior analysis of response effort and making sure that the teacher is going to contact reinforcement at a high enough level when they change something. So things are truly efficient rather than just effective, right? So I just, for anybody, you know, who's a behavior analyst, you could do a system that's every 5 seconds that we know is going to be effective. But what can be implemented in the public school system, and what can be efficient so that the teachers can contact reinforcement, one, for your consultation, but two, also they can see the change in the child as well, so that the response effort isn't too high for the effort that the teacher's putting in.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And that's, yeah, I think on both those sides, that's great. Great advice, because that is probably the most common thing, I think, in any public school system, maybe in the world, you know, where there's that tension of what can actually be done in the reality of the school system. I want to touch a little bit more about working with parents. And so when they're hiring you, are they expecting you to like come in and take the lead? Like, how does that usually happen when you come in? Because I imagine maybe they've already had some meetings. Especially for you, Alexandra, like things have come to this point where you're coming in and there's going to be legal action. But what does, so Annie, like you mentioned, like the values conversation, what are the expectations of the family, I suppose, when they come in? Maybe this is more for Annie, I suppose, because it's probably quite clear for you, Alexandra, that you're going to be taking some legal action. But what are the expectations?
Well, even when I show up, I look to her and I'm like, so you're taking the lead, right?
Like, how does that work? I guess what I'm trying to get at is the heart of being on a big team, because I also imagine the students that you're working for have multiple staff people working with them, district staff. So how does that kind of go at the table?
Sure. So I really, we talk about it beforehand with the parent, right? Is what to expect when I'm at a meeting. And what I tell everybody is I show up from a collaborative standpoint. I don't try to boss the process around, right? Like, this is the process that they need to follow. They're trying to, you know, get through the meeting, or they need to cover this assessment. So we're not going to jump in there and bring up the problems right away. We're going to bring the problems up when it's time to bring the problems up. So a lot of it is letting parents know the process of what to expect, so that we don't become a punisher, honestly, right? Or an aversive for the team, is that we are waiting for the time to bring things up or how to kind of shift that conversation at the right time. So timing is huge on making sure teams, because they do have their legal obligation to get through things and to get through the process and to be able to address it from their side. So I often want to make sure when I'm working with families that they know, right, these are the three things we're going to bring up. This is what to expect. And this is when I think they're going to come up, so that we can insert them at the right time. So oftentimes I let the process happen. I'm not trying to direct things. I'm not trying to correct every little I that doesn't have a dot on it or a T that's not crossed, because really I don't think that builds a good relationship. So I try to let the teams run. The parents definitely still talk. I always let the parents speak up when you want to speak. Don't feel like you can't say anything and want their voice. And then sometimes they say things and teams move on, and I will pause them and say, hold up. We didn't really address what the parents said. So then I kind of say it again or translate it, or like, how are we going to address it? But oftentimes, you know, my job is to make sure that what they bring up and what they need is addressed, because oftentimes it is kind of just heard rather than addressed. So I pause teams and make sure we stay in figuring out where that is. But usually I try to sit back where I can and just let the things happen that need to happen, and then insert where we need to be.
Oftentimes I think Annie and I both hear parents being like, I'm going to let you take the lead. And I think part of that is because what I said before, which is that it's emotional to talk about your own kid. And two, oftentimes, more for me than for Annie, by the time they've gotten to us, they're exhausted. And they've tried on their own and it hasn't worked. And I think that's probably true for Annie too. Like, they've tried on their own and it hasn't worked. And they are resentful or tired, and they would just want somebody else to take over. Like, they're relieved for somebody else to take over. And I think one thing that I haven't really talked about ever out loud before, but I think it's sort of an elephant in a lot of IEP rooms, is you're dealing with a parent who has a child with a disability. And like, that's going to be hard forever. And you go into meetings, and I think, you know, maybe perhaps this is more skewed for someone like me who has a kid with Down syndrome and met the friends that I know, but you're going into this meeting, into meetings oftentimes with this underlying fight in you of, my child is worthy. My child has a right to be here. My child should be valued for who they are and seen for their gifts. That is an emotional undercurrent for parents all the time when you have a child with a disability. And so it's just emotional. And it's hard to focus on the facts and the specifics. And so I think that's part of the relief of having someone there with you who can do that. Like, I know my friends will just be like, I've been stressed for days before my IEP meeting. Even though there's no conflict necessarily, it's just like it brings up all of these feelings you have as a parent of a child with a disability.
Yeah, that's really insightful and so powerful, I think, for educators to hear, whether they're parents or not. Because like I said, I think if you're working in a school, it just becomes normalized, these meetings. But to be coming in from the outside with that, yeah, the emotions in that, that's a lot. So I think good for educators to be hearing that. And, you know, I wanted to ask a little about tools that you folks use, like when you're going into your meetings. And it just sounds like your soft skills are quite powerful. Like you were saying, Annie, about like knowing the values and like sitting back and like letting things happen and helping the parent like translate. That seems like such a powerful tool of like doing that translation. I'm sure for you, Alexandra, too, translating what the parent is wanting into what will work for the school. Are there any other tools that you can think of or strategies that you would recommend to other people in your respective positions?
Valid and comprehensive evaluations. So often we're dealing with bad or absent evaluations, because like that's what Annie and I rely on a lot of the time is, okay, like, where's the data to show that this is a deficit? And oftentimes the school hasn't even thought to do an evaluation, or they haven't done one in a long time, or they're so convinced that, you know, we know what this child needs, we haven't done a formal evaluation in 7 years. And so oftentimes what I'm recommending to parents is they go out and get outside evaluations, which shouldn't be the case. We shouldn't have to pay for evaluations that are provided for free by the school system. But I think a lot of that is like oftentimes the first step in a case for us is like, go out and get an evaluation, or we need the school system to properly evaluate, or we need to talk to the school system about how this evaluation wasn't valid or comprehensive, because that's going to drive a lot of the argument. And I think it's often something that schools don't, it is oftentimes the thing that schools has not done well.
Yeah. And I think being super clear on the data that is provided, right? And so if it's not a formal evaluation, but it's a present level or it's a progress report, really making sure that they match. So there's oftentimes a lot of information, but not a lot of data that is directly related to the goal and objective. For example, the child's supposed to learn the consonant sounds, and the progress or the present level says, you know, he participates well in reading group. He's a pleasure to have. That's lovely. Thank you for being positive, right? But how many consonants does he know? And those kinds of things. So I think as a strategy and a tool is just to make sure that you can read that and know that you need to ask for the data that is directly related to the skills that are being taught in the IEP.
Yeah, the measurable baseline data. Because then we don't even know whether what we're doing is appropriate or working if we don't have that data.
I'm curious about mediation strategies. Alexandra, I'm sure this is like something that you've been trained in extensively, but do you have a few basic tips for any practitioner, like just putting yourself into the shoes of an OT in an IEP meeting who's not trained in this area or experienced or whatnot? What are some basic mediation skills for those situations that are a little more deadlocked and heated?
I think a phrase that we often use is like, thank you for all you've done, but something isn't working. And I think, so Annie alluded to this too, is like, thank you for everything that you've done. I think the needs of the student is exceeding what he's currently being provided.
That sounds, yeah, like you said, Annie, like people are trying, and I really like that. You know, it's like acknowledging what has been done, but also acknowledging that it's still not working.
I was going to say, I think that there's some relief and having that really frank conversation of this isn't working, because I think oftentimes this is kind of a guess on my part that teachers feel like it has to work because what else are they going to do? And so to have an outside person say the data is showing that he's just not making sufficient progress, or like this isn't working, or his needs exceed what the school is providing, is like, a release valve in some ways, because I think that oftentimes educators and therapists aren't getting the support they need. Like, oftentimes they're needing an integrative wraparound approach and they're an island of one. So I think, you know, just sort of being able to acknowledge that can be helpful.
Yeah. Just step into it, get it done, and put it out there. Yeah. Anything to add, Annie?
Yeah, I mean, I think I do think being clear in the message helps with mediation, or to like come to an agreement on something, or at least know you disagree, which I think is an important part of all of this. Is I have so many families that come to me and say, we had 10 IEP meetings last year and nothing got done. It's like, holy, I mean, that's a lot of time and effort for everybody, right? For the 10 people around the table and for the parent and the stress and all of that. And it's like nothing got done. So I think at times, you know, to be very direct about what the ask is and then use kind of what's in the law for the district to have to respond in the prior written notice about do they agree or disagree and why. Because I just find that you can't just keep talking about the same thing over and over again. So you need to know if they disagree, then you have the parents have their rights about disagreement. But oftentimes, because disagreement feels so uncomfortable and you're not really sure, I find a lot of times parents walk out and they're like, we said a lot, but I'm not really sure if they what they said they were going to do or not do. Like, they were kind of nice about it. And I'm like, well, they were nice about it, but they said they weren't going to do it. And they said they were going to do it. Yeah, that's exactly what they said, but they didn't say it directly. So oftentimes I'm saying, you know, I'm reiterating again of, okay, so this was asked for. Are you saying you're doing it or you're not going to do it? And they'll be, we're not going to do that. Okay, put that in the prior written notice and let's move on. Because oftentimes, you know, you're just going to talk about the same thing for these hour meetings for 45 minutes of it, and you just don't get anywhere. So
I'm laughing because that happened to me yesterday. Because they were like, I said something. They're like, okay. I'm like, what's the response? We'll put that in the notes. No, I'm not asking for you to put it in the notes, because what the law says about prior written notice is the prior written notice has to include what was suggested, whether it was agreed upon, refused, and the data to support that decision. That's what a prior written notice is. And so I think that's, you know, talking about tools and what you use, we use the prior written notice to document the parent requested this, the team's response was this, the data that they used to support the decision was this, document disagreement, and you move on and you decide what to do with that information.
And now in some states, disagreement means different things, right? So some states you have to sign an IEP every time you change it and stuff. So I do think documenting disagreement is huge. And then knowing what your state disagreement options are is really important for families to navigate.
Yeah, those are all very practical tips in those kind of, sorry. Yeah. And I wasn't clear on what I meant by mediation, not the legal, but thank you. Those are helpful things for anybody walking in. Cause I think, like you said, there aren't a lot of IEP advocates out there, specifically those roles. I think people probably know about education law, but, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of providers that are just finding themselves in IEP meetings, and just having some of those basic tools and tips is helpful. The last thing I want to touch on before we wrap up is your working relationship together. Now, you did mention at the beginning that you've had a couple times where you kind of had to go back and forth with each other and deciding, like, maybe you had different views on how to move forward. I'm curious about how you kind of collaborated together and came out of some of those situations where you had different views on something.
Well, I'm going to defer to Annie. Like, Annie is the expert, right? I mean, so, and part of that is a strategy. Like, if my expert doesn't agree with what my client wants, then I know that on the stand, she's not going to say that this is what she needs. So I know I don't have the support of an expert. Like, she's an expert to whom I rely upon to support those arguments. So if she's saying, look, I just don't think, you know, X, Y, and Z, I'm going to listen to that. We collaborate, but we very much have our own roles. And I don't want it to ever seem like or be like she is a hired hand. She's not. She's her own expert. And I'm simply trying to ensure that the team does what she's recommending. Because that comes up, and also, you know, that comes up in cases too. Like, we're going to try to certify, our goal is to certify her as an expert. And if a judge thinks that she's just toeing the line for what the family wants me to say, then that's not a successful case. And so that's how I operate. I would never ask her to do something that she doesn't professionally or ethically agree with. And if she disagrees, then, you know, I'm not going to ask her to do something different.
Yeah. And I think sometimes, right, cases are complex, right? So there may be parts that we like, this is exactly what should happen. And I'm positive about that. And then there are parts that like the situation is difficult. And so we go, how are we going to approach this? Is it going to be in an IEP meeting? How are we going to talk to the parents about it? So, you know, and it's kind of funny to hear Alexandra say she defers to me. It took me a while as a behavior analyst, really, truly, that was part of my, how can I say for sure what they need, right? Like, where's the date? We haven't done an AB design to say this is exactly what this child needs. And it really was through working with attorneys that they helped me understand what an expert opinion is. Like, they had to operationally define that for me. And it really is using that experience, training, expertise to develop an opinion and to have as much support around that opinion on what an individual needs. And truly, things get super complicated for me because I do have a contract with some school districts where I do training for them. I have been an expert in some of their cases. So I do work with school districts. I work with families. I have to be really clear about conflicts. There are times when we'll kind of joke and be like, well, I can't talk to you about, you know, about this because I think you're the attorney on that case, right? And she's like, I don't know. I'm like, well, I have a letter that has your name on it and your, you know. And so we do, I think there are times when those things happen, but to me that really has to put us in like that professional lane, right? Of like, this is, I would say this when I testify, I have, and this is true, I'm not going to lie for anybody, right? Like that's my ethics. That's my morals. So no matter whether it's district pressure, attorneys, parents, like I have to really be able to go to sleep at night and not go to jail for lying to like tell. So like, and that's what I tell families and attorneys, right? You can ask me, and if I give you my opinion and you disagree with it, tell me because we can talk through that. Maybe I can explain it differently. Maybe I can show you some research. Maybe we can talk about it. Or you can fire me, right? Like I'm not going to lie or make things up or things like that when we kind of have some of those tough spots because we have kids that are super complex. You know, I would say the easy cases don't make it to us, but some of the really complex cases are hard.
The other reason why I end up deferring to her is I often don't meet my clients. I mean, the clients are the parents, but I don't meet their child. And one of the values to Annie is like, she's the eyes on the ground. She's the boots on the ground. And so it's really difficult to be advocating when you don't know the child. And so that's partly why I end up recommending to clients that they hire her. Like I always say, I can help you create the best IEP possible, but unless you have someone going in and seeing what's actually happening, whether they're implementing, we don't know if this is working. And so that's part of why I'm deferring to her because, you know, usually at a team meeting, I'm the person that knows the child the least. I'm just trying to follow the law.
That makes sense. It sounds like such a great, yeah, complementary skill set that you both have working together. And I just wanted to add on a, hopefully a positive note. Do you have any, without getting into details to protect confidentiality, do you have any success stories that you could share where the two of you have either worked together or if one of you wants to share a story just about how advocacy and or maybe one that stands out or even like a kind of a general story?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, the cases that I would say are successful really are the children start to thrive. They feel like they belong. They feel like a valued member of their community, and they're making tremendous progress academically, communication, behaviorally. And I will tell you, and that the parents feel confident that they made the best decision. So we often work with cases where all of those things are really even like rocky or like difficult. And so I would say how we define success sometimes, you know, and I think it's a little bit different. Alexander the other day said, I either win a case or I lose a case. And to me, you know, I think it's just such an evolution of a case that we have worked together across lots of counties, lots of ages, lots of disabilities together. And there tend to be just lots of growth on school teams and parents for the benefit of the child. But we tend, I think, to zoom in on one would be really hard, but just to know that, you know, we do work, I would say, you know, we've had done kindergarten to 21, right, across lots of disability categories. In general, I tend to focus on autism, intellectual disabilities, emotional behavior disorders as the categories or multiple disabilities. And so those tend to be the cases that I take. I feel like I could do specific learning disabilities and things like that that are other categories, but I can do the others that much easier, right? And it's just right now where I am in my life with my three young kids that I just like to stick with what I know. So I think that's when I think about stories of kind of how to tell them. We do tend to get some cases in the Down syndrome community because of Alexandra's connection with that community, as well as I do some trainings with them as well. I think that it's an amazing community to work with.
I mean, so I think the idea that most of the time parents are right really means that, I'm at the risk of sounding like I'm exaggerating, like we do win most of, we pretty much win all the cases we bring. And part of that is, I will say, like, I sought out what I thought was the best, one of the best special education attorneys in the state. And I said, I want to work with you. And so I'm also have the benefit of working for Mark Martin, who has a long history of being an extremely talented and intelligent advocate. And, you know, part of it is knowing that if they don't give us what we want, then we're going to probably have a pretty successful litigation. And I think that helps a lot. And so it's a combination of what I bring to the table and the firm that I'm a part of. At the risk of sounding hyperbolic, it is amazing how many times I have heard the phrase, I feel like I have a different child. Because oftentimes, again, they come to us when things have just gotten so bad. And when they are finally in the right placement with the appropriate IEP, it feels like they have a different child. Or the phrase is, I have my child back. That happens a lot. Or I was talking to a client that was like, work refusal was the biggest thing that happened at the school. And we're talking about whether collecting data about work refusal at the new school. And the new school's like, we don't have any data because he's not refusing to do any work. Like, it's just not a thing here. I mean, so, you know, what the new school sees is an entirely different kid than what's happening before.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah, that must be so motivating for you to continue your work when you hear those stories. Yeah.
On those hard days, right?
Yeah. Yeah, just think about those statements. Wow, that's beautiful. Well, thank you so much to both of you. I really, really appreciate your insights. I think you had so many amazing takeaways there for other professionals who are in related situations. So thank you for that. And have a great afternoon.
The comments and views expressed in this podcast do not constitute or replace contractual behavior analytic consultation or professional advice. Views expressed are solely the perspective of the speaker and do not represent the views or position of their colleagues, employer, or other associates. Please seek out a behavior analyst if you would like to receive further behavior consultation. Until next time, take care.